Well, I'll tell you what I was teaching our classes, right? Okay, the biggest problems with combatives, implementing combatives throughout the army. The first biggest problem is cowardice. Like, there's no way that anybody can argue with any sort of like intelligent thing going on to say that soldiers don't need to know how to fight, right? And as soon as it comes out of your mouth, the soldiers know you're a pansy. Like, you can't bullshit soldiers, right? They can see your soul. And if you're against soldiers learning how to fight, you are a pansy. And that's that.
Hello, team. Welcome back to another week with Drew and Alex here on the Mops and Mos podcast. Although we provide gripping content to you guys every week, sometimes we go a few weeks without actually seeing each other. Alex, it's been some time.
It's been a while. We almost forgot how to do this.
We did. I had to download an update on Zoom. So we're back.
Ooh, rough. Drew, have you ever been to a Scheels, the store?
Scheels?
Yeah.
Scheels?
I think it's Scheels, something like that.
Is this some like Midwestern Colorado stupid?
So I don't actually know.
No,
where
I've never
it's
been to a
based.
Scheels.
I had never been to one until a week ago either. I'd never even heard of one until a few weeks ago. It is an experience. You could go not to buy anything. You could go just to have the experience.
I think Nate Bargatze has a bit on Scheels. It's like an outdoor store or something.
Yeah, it's sort of an outdoor store. The way I would describe it is, if you've been to a Bass Pro Shop before, right?
Yeah, overrated.
Take Bass Pro Shop and make it 5 times bigger and 10 times more conservative.
So probably never going there.
So, like, just brief observations. First thing you see when you walk in is the Ferris wheel.
Oh my God.
Well, before you walk in, there's bronze statues outside, a number of bronze statues.
Of what?
Some of them are like outdoor recreation, and some of them are just historical figures.
I was expecting Robert E. Lee.
I'm pretty sure Abe Lincoln was sitting on a bench. there was a guy carrying a elk head in a bronze statue, like a giant statue carrying an elk head. Just an astonishing array. I mean, it's got your normal apparel. It's got your camping stuff. It's got your pants and shirts and stuff.
I just Googled Scheels, and you're right. There's a Ferris wheel.
Yeah, not kidding around here, man. It's a whole thing.
Dude.
If just the gun portion was a standalone store, it would easily be one of the biggest gun stores in the city. Huge array of knives, bows, everything. If people like doing shit in the outdoors of any kind, and if they are particularly interested in merchandise that supports both that and a right-leaning political ideology, Scheels is your
mecca. This is literally, I just looked up their map. It is America. If you divided America into thirds, you had the West Coast, the Middle, and the East Coast. It is exclusively the middle.
Nice.
There's about nothing right on the West Coast unless you include Reno. And the furthest east they go is Springfield, Missouri.
That tracks. That's about right.
So it's a lot of big square shaped states. Interesting. Yeah, probably never going to go there.
I have a feeling like listeners on here are astonished that I'd like never heard of it and never been, because I feel like it caters to a similar audience as the military.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems like the kind of place that's close to a Midwestern military base.
Yeah, for sure. I think people at those Midwestern military bases would absolutely love Scheels.
A lot of financing options at Scheels. You can finance a lot of things.
For sure. High
APRs. Anyway.
Should we get to an actual episode conversation here?
I was waiting for you to introduce who we were going to be talking to.
Okay. Well, I'll say this has happened to us a few times now. As we get cooler and cooler guests, their bios get longer and longer. I did my best to compress this bio down into something of a digestible length, but it's still definitely on the long side for some of our intros. So Matt Larson he started out as a Marine, and then he became a U.S. Army Ranger, best known as a combatives instructor, often referred to as the father of modern combatives. He's credited with the creation of the Army's modern combatives doctrine and the establishment of the U.S. Army Combative School. He enlisted in the Marine Corps as an infantryman in 1984 and got stationed in Japan. During his time there, he began training in judo, Shotokan karate, and traditional boxing. Just some examples of his activities in Japan. He fought in the Japan Karate Association's All Japan Karate Championships. He fought Muay Thai bouts in Thailand, and he had a bare knuckle boxing fight against the Korean Marines Taekwondo champion. He's also a member of the 3rd Marine Division's boxing team. This is a guy who likes fighting. Matt then transitioned from the Marine Corps to the Army and made his way to Ranger Regiment. He was initially assigned to 1st Ranger Battalion, with whom he parachuted into Panama during Operation Just Cause and was also involved in Ranger operations during the Gulf War. Then he moved over to 2nd Ranger Battalion, and at this point he had already found a role as a combatives instructor, and it became more formal at 2nd Battalion, becoming the non-commissioned officer in charge of combatives and close quarters battle. He started developing a more formal curriculum there, which led him to taking over the combatives program for all of Ranger Regiment. He then moved on to 11th Infantry Regiment, where he was invited to establish a combative schoolhouse and was given a warehouse to do so. Pretty quickly, that became a lot more than the 11th Infantry School. Units from across the Army were sending people for training. Several new courses were developed with the idea of building programs within the units of everybody who was coming to the course. Eventually, that was recognized officially as the U.S. Army Combative School. And then in 2002, the training manual he'd been working on since his time with Ranger Training Brigade was published as FM3-25.150, the official combatives manual. Fast forward to today, after more than a decade of leading combatives for the Army, he now works at West Point's Department of Physical Education as the director for their combatives program.
Matt's a badass.
And you'll get that vibe very quickly.
I didn't even realize he was in a bare knuckle boxing match with a Korean. I mean, that's insane.
Yeah, I feel like he's been in more than a couple bare knuckle boxing matches.
But I think what you guys will quickly realize talking to Matt is that it's the combatives piece, and sort of some of the questions we were curious about is like, how do you set up a combatives program and what does that look like? But I think more importantly, he gets into, and quite frankly, he's pretty straightforward about it, just how to develop, what should we call it, a warrior mindset, and the role that combatives can play in that. And for folks like you that went to West Point or some of the military academies, there's still some of that martial tradition, but I think certainly in Matt's opinion, and probably ours too, there's places for, or I should say that there's a place for a lot more of that in the modern military. And no pun intended, but Matt holds no punches in his thoughts and opinions on the matter.
I would say that Matt has some really interesting layers. He's the father of combatives. He as soon as he tuned in, you immediately notice his Embrace Violence t-shirt. He's a guy who clearly loves fighting and loves talking about fighting. But at the same time, he's pretty well-versed in behavioral psychology. His focus is academic career there, and we had a pretty cool conversation about moral injury as well. He's not a guy who just wants to beat you up. He was a guy who wants to, well, probably beat you up, but also teach you how to beat up others in a well-developed, cohesive, intelligently designed training curriculum.
Yeah, he'll beat you up in like a, you know, physically and mentally in such a way that you'll come back stronger. So without any further ado, leave that shields behind and enjoy the episode. Can I ask you a dumb question?
Ask all the questions you want.
Okay, now this is me as a civilian having not gone to West Point or ever been in the military, and you are the father of Army combatives.
Yeah, sort of, yeah.
What were they doing before you got there?
Nothing really.
Fair enough.
So there's been a hand-to-hand combat program. That's not true. There's been hand-to-hand combat doctrine for a very long time, right? So the first Army hand-to-hand combat manual was a bayonet fencing manual that was published by, or was a translation from, a French manual by George McClellan when he was a captain. So that was in 1852, right? So we've had doctrine ever since then. But since World War I, really, there hasn't been a program. As in, nobody learned anything. Nobody was like producing instructors. And so what you ended up with was these residual programs that kind of came out of the manual, but really nobody knew shit except for people who studied outside of the Army. You know, that's kind of, there'll be people who dispute that, but I will promise you that none of those people like were involved in any sort of program where they learned how to fight in the army and then passed that on to other people in the army. It's just not a thing.
I'm just thinking of like the landscape of the time frame you just gave. So like World War One, sure. For example, did other countries have a
not really. So program? So the thing to remember is that like so in World War One we went from maybe 125,000 or something soldiers in 1914 in the army, you know, to several million by the time we had 1918, and it was largely a conscript army. So imagine that was when we invented concepts like basic training. Before that, when you joined the army, you went to a unit and they taught you how to be a soldier in the unit. So there was no like concentrated, you know, all the new people come here for training.
Sort of thing. I guess that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. So they had before that, they had a bayonet fencing program, but it was like a bayonet fencing competitions within units, between units, et cetera. You know, bayonet fencing was even an Olympic sport up until the 36 Olympics. It was, you know, fencing was foil, epee, saber, and bayonet. So like it was much more than people even remember now. And it was a skill-based program, just like fencing, you know, other styles of fencing. So whenever World War One came along, they all of a sudden had like a very short amount of time to train up a whole lot of people, which meant they didn't really have any way to impart skill. And so imagine at one point you were probably getting people in with like 4, 5, 6 weeks max of training in basic and then shipping to their unit, then off to France to go to the trenches, you know? So it's not like you're going to take somebody and teach them, you know, the sport of basketball in 4 weeks and then they're going to go out and be able to play a game. Right. And fighting is similar to that. Mm-hmm. Right? So that kind of went on all through the 20th century. You know, they like you guys are familiar with pugil sticks, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. So
pugil sticks were invented by a guy who ran the kinesiology department at University of Arizona, I believe. And he also designed the Marine Corps bayonet fighting system that was in the World War II era. Well, he invented pugil sticks specifically so that you could get all the benefits of competition without skill. Hmm. So imagine. So the bayonet assault course, pugil sticks, all that stuff was invented to train conscript armies with the assumption that you didn't have the time to be able to give them any sort of real skill.
Hmm. So you mentioned in there that prior to having a program in place, it was just people who trained outside of the army or had a background outside of the army. And that implies that they're doing some variation of civilian martial arts, right? They're doing Taekwondo, they're doing Jiu-Jitsu, they're doing something along those lines.
Yeah.
What is the difference between what combatives look like now and those civilian martial arts traditions?
Well, so the main difference in combatives and all civilian martial arts is motivation. And here's what I mean, right? Like imagine the local school, whatever it happens to be. Everybody in that school is paying money to be there and they are self-motivated and they want to learn, right? So that's the easiest thing in the world is to teach self-motivated people something that they want to learn. Okay. So that's not the case in any organization whatsoever, not for any police force, military unit, any organization whatsoever, right? Because what percentage of people in the average line platoon or in the average, you know, company or battalion or division or police force or anything like that want to learn it to begin with? Okay. So combatives is really kind of like, here's what we know about training people in this martial art, whatever it's going to be, or, you know, whatever skill we're going to give them. Like I said, it doesn't matter if we're talking about basketball. If we wanted to learn everybody in the army to learn basketball, we'd have the exact same problem. Not everybody wants to do it. So we'd have to have a plan. Here's the training regimen. And then here's how we get everybody to do it. And that's the military training side. Like I give you an exact analogy. What percentage of the army wants to train on, you know, nuclear, biological, and chemical skills? And the answer to that is zero. No one wants to. So it can't be about self-motivation, right? But yet everybody in the army needs to be trained on that, because if that ever happens, it's going to be everybody, right? So you have to have mechanisms within your force that make people do it and motivate people to do it. You see what I mean? And not just that, if you want them to be good at it, how do you motivate them to pursue excellence?
I think you're saying out loud something that relates to like military fitness in general that doesn't get said out loud very often.
I'm going to say it out loud. I promise you. Yeah.
I think there are probably a lot of coaches listening to this who are because a lot of the coaches came from collegiate or pro sport into military strength and conditioning. And it's definitely different. Like there's a different level of intrinsic motivation to perform at their best in a physical domain. And it depends on what kind of unit you're in. It might be a little bit different in the 82nd compared to a sustainment brigade somewhere else. Like who knows? But I think that's something we probably don't talk about enough.
I mean, it's a similar problem, right? Like there's only very, very few units where everybody's self-motivated for fitness. And fitness is like something you really can't argue against in the Army, right? Like, and yet most units around, you have a very small group of people who are fit and everybody else is trying to avoid it or doing just what they're required to do. Now I'll give you some pretty good examples. Like you guys are familiar with the whole Master Fitness program, right? So why is the Master Fitness program a failure? And it always has been, and it always will be.
He's saying it out loud again. He's doing
that's right.
Thing.
I'm going to say it out loud, right? Because it's a failure. Because who's responsible for PT in a unit? It's the commander. So who do you send to Master Fitness Trainer School? Some staff sergeant or something like that. And he comes back and who's he's in charge of training? A squad. So his squad will be better trained, right? Hmm. But the company won't be because he's not in charge of training that company.
I got to go off for a second. I know Drew wants to bring this back to some of the history of how.
No, you guys run with it. I can clearly ask a canned question later.
The title of the podcast, the title of the platform is Mops and Mos, Measures of Performance and Measures of Effectiveness. And the reason I started like hyper fixating on that concept was because I was teaching Master Fitness Trainer and I kept asking at the schoolhouse, I was like, this job is fun. I love training people to do this. I do not know whether I'm having any impact on the force. Like we haven't even tried to measure it. And I suspect that if we did try to measure it, if we did look at do units with more Master Fitness Trainers have better results than units without them, I don't think we would find a consistent result. I don't think there would be any particularly significant difference. And it's not because the curriculum was bad and it's not because there wasn't any opportunity to do it. There were just structural things in the way where we were not set up to have the impact that needed to happen. And that was a really frustrating experience. I don't know. I loved working there, but I continue to have conversations about, is it actually working?
Yeah. So you're exactly right on that. And the variables are who's the commander, what do they know about it? And then what's their leadership style and et cetera. And it's got very little to do with who within the unit has what knowledge, you know? But I'll give you an example of like a difference between that and a program that does work, you know. So imagine when we changed to the ACFT, recently, right? So I use this as a teaching point in my classes. So what was the goal of the ACFT when we implemented it, right? So I would boil it down to the old PT test didn't really motivate anybody to be strong. Right. Mm-hmm. So the old things we did, so you could be if I was in a Ranger regiment for most of my career, right? We were all about running. So average Ranger weighed like 165 pounds. We all ran like the wind, you know, because there was all these cultural reasons to do that within the regiment. And the APFT was one of those things. You needed to be good at it. You need to be able to pass a 5 mile run standard in 40 minutes, et cetera, right? Okay. So if the ACFT's goal was to make soldiers more value strength more, it was successful, right? And so what percentage of soldiers are doing deadlifts now compared to 6 or 7 years ago, all the way back to the 1950s, right? So that number is drastically higher, okay? Even if it's not everybody yet, it's so close to everybody that it's and now think about all the things that everybody was axle wrapped over about the ACFT, the whole thing with the plank and the knee tuck and all that stuff.
Alex loves a leg tuck.
Yeah, well, look, turns out all that's just noise, right? At the end of the day, what really changed was soldiers are doing more deadlifts. Mm-hmm. And they're valuing strength more than they used to. It's a successful program. It's never going to be 100% successful at anything when you're talking about, you know, a million people spread all over the world. But the goal is culture change. And your culture change is about changing people's values within the organization so that they value what you want them to. And so they value strength more than they used to. Ha, success.
how do you mimic that with combatives? Because I think at some point, you know, we'll get into discussion about kind of cultivating the warrior mindset and all that kind of thing. But like with a program like combatives, and I'm just thinking outside of the box here.
Yeah.
And with a arguably kind of like a peacetime military, struggling with retention, struggling with, maybe you could say struggling with like the edge, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Like, how could you take a program like combatives and make that successful at scale, like you're saying the ACFT has done?
Well, so let me, I'll tell you a story, because I teach this lesson, right, to all of our cadets. So once upon a time, back in the early 2000s, the chief of staff of the Army, the sergeant major of the Army, both came down to what would eventually become the Army Combative School. At the time, it wasn't yet. We were just teaching local people. And they had their big entourage with them. So it was probably like 60 people, right? So mm-hmm. I looked at the group and I said, okay, who's the best runner? And everybody knew immediately. They were all like, oh, you know, Major Longlegs, he just won the Marine Corps Marathon or whatever, right? I'm like, oh, kick ass, man. I'm all about that, you know? And I said, okay, who's the best shot? And now there were crickets, right? Nobody had any idea who the best shot was. And so then I said, okay, who's the best fighter? Once again, crickets, no? I said, so what you're telling me is that this organization values running, but does not value shooting and fighting. Because if you valued it at all, you'd know who was good at it, right? So you can give lip service to valuing stuff all day long, but if you're not living it out, then you don't actually value it, right? That's our actual character is that, right? So with that being said, the question is, why did they value running? Well, they value running for the same reason everybody else in the Army does, is because we run collectively. You know, every morning the Army falls out, right phase, forward march, double time, takes off on a run, right? And about a mile into that run, somebody starts falling out. And what does everybody in the Army think about that person?
They suck.
Yeah, we all think the same thing. And you don't even have to tell that to a soldier what you think, because they all know what you think, right? And even that turd wishes some other turd would fall out first, so that everybody would be thinking that of that person instead of them, right? Okay, so that's why we value running. And it's not just that. So there's the threat of public humiliation associated with every time you go on a unit run. It's not just a PT session. It is a social event, okay? But not just the threat of public humiliation. Also the promise of accolades, right? The rabbits, if you get halfway on that run and the leader says, okay, release, and they all take off, everybody wishes they were one of those rabbits. I mean, maybe not enough to do the PT to be one, right? But you get the idea. So that's why we value running. So then I use shooting in this as well, because imagine this, when the last time soldiers went to the range, I always ask them, like, who knows how you did? Mm-hmm. And the answer is nobody, except for the person who helped you finger whip your score and the clerk. And the only thing that gets like reported up the chain of command is like numbers. You know, we had five people score expert. We had, and if you're somebody who's a failure, maybe they get, but even then probably, you know, we're not going to get the range again to go send the failures back for more training. You know what I'm saying? There's going to be logistical reasons why that's not going to happen. So what if you went to, when you went to the range, you came back and you published all the scores? What would happen? Well, we know what would happen, right? Humans are pretty easy to figure out. They'd walk up, everybody would come back to the company area, look down the list and say, oh, Larson, bottom of the list. You suck at this, right? Like, why do we even give you a rifle, man? You can't hit shit anyway, right? So that dynamic, you know, as well as giving somebody at the top accolades, you know what I mean? Like, maybe you get Thursday off, or maybe you get to wear a special hat or something, you know? Yeah, the Army does that, like, we wear special hats for high performers. So that being said, you know, like, if you do stuff like that, then pretty soon when you go to the range next time, everyone will be more serious about marksmanship, because there's a social dynamic tied to it now. Right. So how do you capture that with fighting? Well, the short answer is you got to get people fighting. If you get people fighting, then that social dynamic happens on its own. You know what I mean? Because like, I can tell you how we used to do it in the Ranger Regiment when we first started. We used to have on payday activities, right? We used to have big formations on payday, and the battalion sergeant major would call people out at random and say, like, okay, give me the first squad leader, first platoon Alpha Company, and the second squad leader, second platoon Bravo Company. And those guys would come out in front of everybody and fight, right? So grapple, you know? And so imagine what happens if somebody's just like over there running their mouth, you know, like, I'll just shoot you. This combative stuff is stupid, blah, blah, blah. And they get called out. And then some hammer from the other company twists them up like they're you know, like they're closing the bread with him or something. And then this clown now has to run back and take over his squad again, outed as a shit talking pansy. You know what I mean? So like that only has to happen one time. And then a whole unit realizes you can't be that guy anymore because it's not socially acceptable. And everybody starts training, right? So it's that experience for that guy is just like falling out of the run. It's the exact same thing. Gets humiliated in front of everybody, and he doesn't want to do that anymore if he's worth a shit. And so then he gets motivated, right? So you capture that same dynamic every time. If you like, okay, everybody in the platoon, you know, partner up, you know, on your knees, shake hands, bump, go, and everybody starts rolling. What's actually going on is everybody's judging everybody. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, we're getting better, but we're all judging each other too. Like somebody rolls with me and they ball me up, and somebody next guy rolls with me and balls me up, and a third guy rolls with me and balls me up. I'm starting to get a reputation as somebody who maybe isn't the guy you want with you in a fight. You know what I mean? Or it could be the other way. Like I'm a hammer. I just crush everybody. Then everybody's like, yeah, that's the guy you want, right? He's a monster. And so if you do that, then you change the value structure within the organization. People start like, just like we currently do with running, you know, people start valuing that person who's a hammer fighter. And then you, that's a, you know, everything changes.
Do you, now I will raise my hand and say, I am not familiar with combatives, broadly speaking.
Yeah.
But what I'm wondering is if, as you're saying that, is this a program that is beholden to metrics to prove success? Like how do you show success of the program or not? Are you ever even held to that standard? Because that's one of the things that we hear all the time.
So we're not
struggle with. Yeah.
So we're not, but I can tell you how. So I used to, back when I was running the program as a civilian down at Fort Benning, Fort Moore now, I used to travel around the Army all the time, and it was my mandate to go inspect programs. Okay. So I would show up someplace like a division or something like that and get with whoever's in. And we just drive around the division area and pick people out at random and see if they knew anything. You know what I mean? So you can tell straight away if the soldiers know it. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, you two, show me the rear naked choke. Show me the bent arm bar. Show me, et cetera. If they know it, they know it. If they don't, unit doesn't have a program, you know? Or you can measure the percentages like that if you wanted to. Because it's really the measure of success is the level of the average member of the unit. So that means if they know it and they are competent fighters, well, then you win, right? That's what victory looks like.
So the measure of success is the level, by level, I'm assuming you're meaning like
fighting ability,
which you would measure by, I'm going to sound like an idiot, belt.
No. But more on that later. Right. But just the first thing would be, do they know the things they're supposed to know? Because if you know them all, the program is set up in a pretty sophisticated way. So if you know the things you're supposed to know, it is reliably predictive of your fighting ability. So, and I mean, if we put you to fight somebody, we can see what you know.
Well, right? And see, the reason I asked that question is because look at like you mentioned the ACFT, look at embedded human performance programs. Their standard is, if not every soldier is making a 600, if not every soldier is maxing their PT test, this program is a failure. It will go away versus
we know that isn't real, right? Like,
but exactly. But these are the things, these are the conversations happening. And so it's interesting that for a program like martial arts, or combatives, I guess, there seems to be this intrinsic trust of, hey, this is working. And we're just going to look at kind of the standard across the board and trust that if they can display competency, then it's a thriving
program. So here's the difference between those programs. In fact, I'm going to assume there's some people familiar with the Marine Corps program in here, so I'll draw that. I use that as a distinction too. Okay. So the ACFT is a good example. The ACFT is a top-down program. The Army says everyone must do this. And then they tell you when, and there are standards, and commanders are held accountable, and et cetera, right? The Marine Corps martial arts program is very similar to that. The commandant decided they wanted to have a program. He got some squared away guys to design it. They implemented it. It's exactly what the Marine Corps says it's going to be. The Army Combatants program is not that way at all. It is an organic program that grew from the bottom with nobody at the top of the Army wanting it to happen. Like it's organic. It just started from the, and I'll tell you the story. You know, General McChrystal, Stan McChrystal, when he was the commander of the 2nd Range Battalion, he ordered us to start doing combatives. And when he did, there was no combatives program in the Army, but there was a manual. So we busted out the manual and started doing what it said to do. And we went back to him after a while and told him, this is stupid. And like, it's a waste of time doing all this martial artsy bullshit, right? and we'd rather be like shooting and rucking and, you know, something that we were going to get some training benefit out of, make us better soldiers, you know, more capable units. And so he said, well, it's not hand-to-hand that's the problem. It must be the way, you know, the method we have or the program we have. So figure out a better way. So we started figuring out a better way. And the way that really played out at the end of the day, I was a staff sergeant at the time. I was a squad leader in Charlie Company 2nd Range Battalion. And I was training. I'd been a martial artist for a while, but I had just recently started learning Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. So I started training my squad on how to grapple. So pretty soon everybody in my squad was competent grappler and they could beat all the guys in the platoon. So then we started training the platoon and then the company and then the whole battalion and then the entire Ranger regiment. And then once it was the whole Ranger regiment, the leaders from the Ranger regiment have to go out into the regular Army all the time. They can't just stay there forever. So all the battalion commanders from the Ranger battalions went out to take over brigades. So that was all these high performing guys, right? It's Mike Farriter, who commanded 3rd Ranger Battalion, was eventually MCOM commander. It was Nick Bednarik, who was, also retired as a 3-star, all these high end guys. And all the NCOs from that went out there too. And so as those guys went out in the force, they started petitioning the Army to change the doctrine. Well, the doctrine holder for hand-to-hand combat was the Ranger Training Brigade. So after we had the whole Ranger Regiment training, I transferred over there. So I was in place when those guys asked the Ranger Training Brigade to evaluate the doctrine or the stuff that the Rangers were doing. So it was actually my stuff and it came to me to evaluate, right? It was like I was like, this stuff is brilliant.
You know what I mean? Whoever made this up.
That's right, man. And I was like, where'd you get these supermodels that you used in these pictures, right? Because it was all pictures of me, you know. So anyway, that's how we got to rewrite the manual. Once we did that, Mike Farriter was commanding the 11th Regiment at the time, which is Officer Candidate School, Infantry Officer Basic Course, Captain's Career Course, etc., Airborne School at the time. And he wanted to put it into the curriculum of those organizations so that we were training all the new officers in it. And so he asked me and another guy from 2nd Battalion named Troy Thomas to come over and set up a course to teach the cadre there. So we did. And then as it grew, we needed like that next level of expertise so that people could, you know, hold things to standard and do it safely. And so that kind of grew into the various levels of the combatives program and the various courses. Eventually there were 4 courses, levels 1 through 4. And all that's just, like I said, it just kind of grew up organically as there was demand for it from the grassroots around the Army. So nobody in the Army ever said, hey, do this. Mm-hmm. You know, we just did it from the bottom. You know, we didn't even ask anybody. We just did it, you know? Mm-hmm.
So since you're starting to talk about what the program is and how it developed and things like that, just a fast clarification question, since I realized I was out of date on my knowledge. So I was first introduced to it as levels 1, 2, 3, and 4. I know I had like an early platoon sergeant who was level 4 and could do some crazy stuff in terms of like hand-to-hand defense against an armed opponent. Ridiculous. But I think levels 1, 2, 3, and 4 went away in like 2014 or something, and I'm way behind. What is the system today?
It went to level 3 and 4 consolidated and became the Master Combatives Trainer course. And that's the only real change. Those two things happened. Now, there's an interesting thing. So you equate those levels as if they're skill levels, but they're not. What they were is, so imagine the limitations of institutional training for a second. Okay. So when you're trying to teach a physical skill, right? Imagine we were trying to teach somebody basketball. It's a good one. So somebody shows up on Monday for their 5-day course. They've never held a basketball before, and you're going to teach them the fundamentals of basketball between now and Friday. Okay. So that's a good way of picturing what you could actually accomplish in a Army course. And however long it's going to be that kind of thing, right? Now compare that to any sort of lifetime endeavor like martial arts, right? Like to be actually skillful at it, you're talking about years and years and years for gaining experience and seeking out expertise and et cetera. So the courses have that finite curriculum, but the curriculum is not designed to teach everyone to be better fighters. It's designed to teach them how to become better fighters. So you teach them these fundamental things here, and that illuminates the path forward so they can, well, I'll give you a really good example, okay? So in the level one course, there are three drills that are taught, and each of, and then the requisite skills for those drills. So for example, drill number one is escaping the mounted position. So somebody's sitting on your stomach, how do you get them off of you? Once you get them off of you, you come up inside their legs. Now you got to learn how to get past their legs. When you get past their legs, you're laying cross body, so chest to chest, one person on top, one on bottom. And now you got to learn how to get mounted on them, which is sitting on their stomach. That brings you back to the other person being in that position. So you can do that as a round, okay? So there's three of these drills. And at the end, what they're designed for is to teach the schema of ground grappling. So let me kind of, so all the audience is tracking what I'm talking about here. When you have an area of knowledge, it doesn't matter what it is, you know, math, geography, whatever. There's a map in your brain that connects it all together in a way that makes it all make sense. And that map is called the schema. And so the schema of ground grappling is the hierarchy of position. The worst place somebody can, the worst place you can be is with somebody on your back. It's slightly better if they're on your chest. It's slightly better if they're only on side control. It's slightly better if you put them inside your legs. It's slightly better if you're on top in their legs. It's slightly better if you're past their legs in side control. Slightly better if you're sitting on their chest mounted. It's slightly better if they turn over and you're on their back. So we just went from worst position to best position in order of hierarchy, right? Okay, so that map, if you will, it tells you where you need to go, gives you a sense of objective. Like, I'm here, I need to go there at every step, wherever you happen to end up, okay? And so that's what you're actually learning from the drills. You're learning these fundamental techniques, but they're just a metaphor to teach you how fighting works. Teach you that map, if you will, of the knowledge. And on top of that, you learn training methods. So you learn drilling, you know, live sparring, etc., right? And so whenever somebody comes out of that class, they understand fundamentals of submission grappling and how to get better at it. Okay, so they won't be very good, right? But that's why there's more than one course. So they can't go, like, shouldn't go to like the first one and then the second one back to back, because they need, you know, 6 or 8 months in between to be drilling and fighting and getting better and acquiring skill before they go to the next one. And then the same thing for the next one. So by the time somebody gets through level one, level two, level three, that's only 7 weeks of total training, right? But if you stretch that out over three iterations over the course of 3 years, you really get 3 years of guided training, and then you could actually be pretty good. You get my point? So the program is like, it's not always obvious what we're trying to accomplish all the time with each of the things we're doing, because it's those kind of lessons behind it about how we get the pedagogy to work such that people really gain skill over time. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And as you're saying that, like, my wheels are turning, thinking about a similar maybe problem set in human performance that we struggle with right now, which is kind of that institutional training that you just mentioned and the limitations of the institutional training, which is that in our case, really any branch, you're never going to have as many strength coaches, physical therapists, dietitians, as you do soldiers. But we're having a hard time with strength coaches in particular, kind of letting go of some of the reins and not, like you mentioned, teaching soldiers how to do something, but teaching them how to learn how to do something. Like, that is a very scalable thing. And so I think there's a huge takeaway there, and you kind of nailed it, of, you know, you could take 7 weeks of training, but spread it out over a number of years as that example, and allow the individual to sort of grow into the curriculum. Right. So yeah, I think it's awesome.
Yeah. I think too, like with the, you know, with the way the program is working out there with strength coaches, dietitians, et cetera, I think, you know, the goal is that you would eventually educate your NCO core so that all these like lessons are built into it, because to be the bearer of bad news, programs go away in the Army because money will go away eventually. And if you haven't built into that knowledge into the people who will always be there, well, there will always be commanders and, you know, platoon leaders and et cetera. And there will always be squad leaders, platoon sergeants, those people, and they're always going to be the ones responsible for training their units. So what we have to do is embed all that knowledge in their career path so that they learn it as they go. And by the time you're at this level, you know the stuff requisite to that level. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like a platoon sergeant is, well, a platoon leader is responsible for the fitness of their platoon, and it's happening because the squad leaders are making it happen. Now, what's the method to make sure? Because right now, let's be honest, it's actually just unconscious copying is what's really going on. You know, my squad leader did it this way 15 years ago, and now I'm doing it this way, you know, and it's the same reason why, you know, you could go to a judo club anywhere in America and they're going to be doing the same calisthenics for a warm-up that Jigoro Kano had people doing in 1880, because it's just unconscious copying, right? Like, I mean, that's how we learn sports too, right? How, you know, when you're a kid, you learn how to play baseball. You learn from some dad or something like that. And then how did he learn it? Same mm-hmm. way and back through time, right? Like, it's no like professional education of, you know, little league baseball coaches happening to make sure that our 7-year-olds are getting the fundamental skills down correctly. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just not a thing, right? So, but that's kind of the role of the professionals, in my opinion, is to be able to say, okay, here's what you should know about this young Jedi, so that the rest of your career, you're going to be in charge of units. They will have this knowledge because you're going to give it to them. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah, completely.
I'm going to go on a little bit of a weird ramble here for a second, but I promise it ends with a coherent question. So I was, before this episode, I was scrolling through the Combatives manual, and it mentions at the beginning that Combatives is part of physical readiness training. And that got me curious because there's been a lot of changes to physical readiness training doctrine. So I went and looked at the 2012 version and then the 2020 version of physical readiness training doctrine. In the 2012 version, it mentions combatives 24 times. In the 2020 version, it mentions it one single time, just as an example of a potential anaerobic demand that a soldier might experience. And that is it. It does not mention it as part of programming at all. So my question coming off the back of that is, are you worried that the Army is de-emphasizing combatives training, and how does combatives training fit into physical training overall?
So in the World War II version of the manual, the 1944 version, I think. So if you look at that manual, combatives is a third of it, right? Mm-hmm. So it was integrated doctrine at that point. You learn to be physical and you learn to fight at the same time. Okay. So first, I'm not worried that combatives is going to go away. And I could say that, I'm not going to name any names, but let me just say that at one point in the last 20 years, there was a very powerful person in the Army trying to get rid of it. Mm-hmm. And he did not, and he thought he had the power, but he did not have the power because
somebody beat him
grassroots,
up.
Yeah, it's a grassroots program. You can't tell staff sergeants, you can't train your soldiers to fight wars the way you know how to do it. Mm-hmm. Right? Because the staff sergeant's going to go, I'm still training these guys because our lives are on the line. And so who the fuck are you, right? Like, that's actually what's going to happen, right? So you can't get rid of combatives. It's forever, right? You can even ban it and tell people they can't do it, and they still do it. It's banned in various places around the Army all the time because commanders come in, they're like, this is way too dangerous.
Shoulder injuries, whatever. Yeah.
Whatever it happens to be, right? So it doesn't matter. It just continues rolling because it's a natural part of soldiering. And let's be honest, right? Well, I'll tell you what I was teaching our classes, right? Okay, the biggest problems with combatives, implementing combatives throughout the Army. The first biggest problem is cowardice. Like, there's no way that anybody can argue with any sort of like intelligent thing going on to say that soldiers don't need to know how to fight, right? And as soon as it comes out of your mouth, the soldiers know you're a pansy, right? It's like, you can't bullshit soldiers, right? They can see your soul. And if you're against soldiers learning how to fight, you're a pansy. And that's that. Like, there's no, like, okay, got it, pansy. Like, and it doesn't matter what rank you are or what your position is. Everybody's going to think that, no matter what, right? So leaders know that you can't bullshit soldiers, right? It's like saying, okay, I want all you guys to go on a 12-mile row march, but I'm going to be busy in the office over here because you know, whatever. Right? It's the same thing going on, right? So you can't make an argument, can't make a cogent argument that soldiers don't need to know how to fight. So I'm not worried about it going away. But that doesn't mean we're ever going to be 100% successful either. Okay, so remember what I was saying earlier, the difference between a combative program and training in a local martial arts gym is motivation. Okay, so the thing there is, the large majority of people don't really want to do anything hard. And they definitely don't want to do anything where they might get embarrassed. Okay, and in combatives, you might get embarrassed, right? Your leaders who are the like top of their profession, super studly, great at everything, but they've never learned to fight. Those are the people who are the enemies of soldiers learning to fight because they don't want to be embarrassed, right? So they don't want to do it. And so they're all, okay, so that's not going away. And what else isn't going away is the Army's largely run by civilians, right? So like I had a general officer one time tell me, he was the commander of Fort Benning at the time. He told me, he says, look, being the commanding general of a base like this, it's like blowing on a willow tree, right? Because you can blow for the 2 years you're in command. And the minute you stop blowing, when you leave, the willow tree is going to go right back where it was because all those GS-12s and 13s and 14s and 15s are all sitting in that same desk they were sitting in before you came. And they're really in charge, right? Okay, so let's just understand the reality of the Army and what you can accomplish and what you can't accomplish, right? So what you can accomplish in the Army is that you can keep educating people and you can keep motivating the best people to do the right thing. And the best people will keep pushing to do the right thing. Okay. What you can't do is motivate the turds to do the right thing. And the combatives is that in a nutshell. Look, let me say it right. Like if you claim to be a soldier, right? Okay, so I ask my students, we have written tests in our classes, right? Because we talk about our courses at West Point are actually about how you would manage a program as a platoon leader, a company commander, battalion commander, et cetera. So we're like, it's a leadership class. Hand-to-hand combat is like, we teach it there as a leadership tool. How do you inculcate the warrior ethos into your organization? Here's a tool you have at your disposal to do so. Teach them how to fight, but more importantly, teach them how to train a unit full of people who think as warriors, right? And who are like people of character, who think of themselves as the people who would do the fighting, right? Okay, so when we're going through that whole process, teaching them all that stuff, you know, I ask them, okay, is there a requirement in the Army that you learn combatives? And of course, they mostly say no at the beginning. I'm like, okay, how about this? How many times since you've been in the Army have you said the Soldier's Creed? And that number is thousands of times, right? Like they've said it thousands of times. Okay, so in the Soldier's Creed, it says a couple of things. First thing it says is, I stand ready to deploy, engage, and destroy the enemies of the United States in close combat. Okay, so if you could say that again and again and again and not be somebody who knows how to fight, well, you're a liar and you're not a person of character. And it's that simple, right? Like, debate that all you want. You do not stand ready to destroy the enemies of the United States in close combat. Bam. And then the next one is, it says, I'm an expert in my warrior tasks and drills, right? Okay, so I always ask them, you've said that 1,000 times. Where are those soldiers' warrior tasks and drills listed? And the answer is in the Soldier's Manual of Common Tasks, right? Mm-hmm. Skill level 1, Soldier Manual of Common Tasks. Okay, what's in there? Combatives. So you cannot be a soldier who lives by the Soldier's Creed and not know combatives. You're just a liar. And you're a liar because you're trying to cover up your cowardice because you're afraid you're going to get embarrassed if you get out there and roll with people who are tougher than you. Okay, got it. You know, I've been a soldier a long time. I know what it's like to be the worst runner in the unit. I've been that guy before. You know what I mean? I don't want to go on that run because every time I'm going to get embarrassed. Yeah, that's the guy who's a senior person who doesn't know how to fight. Like, okay, platoon sergeant, you don't know how to fight. Well, you should.
Now I want to go fight somebody.
I do this like once every couple episodes, but breaking the fourth wall and just talking to the audience for a second, the density of practical wisdom we are getting in this episode, the willow tree thing, the warrior ethos thing, it's absolutely killer stuff. But I'm going to guide this in a direction that I think about a lot. And I think about it this comes up a lot with police, not necessarily military, but I think it applies to the military as well.
Sure.
The idea that the ability to apply non-lethal force confidently is a huge deciding factor in terms of how quickly people turn to lethal force.
Exactly right. That's true.
Given the frequency with which the military is called upon to do things that might not be lethal, right? Like crowd control stuff, whatever it is, like we're put in situations with civilians who might be unruly in certain circumstances. There are all these requirements to employ non-lethal force. Like what role does combatives play in like equipping people with the tools to have other options before firing their weapon? I know you know the answer here, but I'm just setting you up to kind of go off.
Yeah. Okay. That I could do. So, so it's a great question. So I had a stepbrother. His name was Joe, and he was a tanker. And when we used to talk, I was a ranger. So, you know, we used to talk about close quarters battle, and his version was like a main gun round from 2,500 meters, you know, like building one clear. Right? So I would tell everybody like, okay, that's a kick-ass technique, right? If you can do that, then do that, right? But here's the truth of the world. If you shoot a main gun round at a building from 2,500 meters, when you get down there to get to that building, there's a pretty damn good chance it's going to be a family or it's going to be a daycare center or something. You just blew up 20 kids. Like, that's the way the world really works, okay? So the reason we send soldiers is because we couldn't send cruise missiles, right? If we could just blow the place off the face of the earth, we'd do that, man. This is the United States of America, right? We have the power to do that, right? But we're ethical people, and we don't do that unless it's the right thing to do, right? So that means we send soldiers. And so we're willing to take casualties, right, in order to not kill innocent people, right? So that's why we send soldiers. Okay, so the way it works out for real when you go through a building, like when was the last time that we sent a bunch of soldiers into a building and said, okay, just go in there and kill everybody? Like a long time ago, right? Maybe that happened in World War II when they were fragging the next room before they came in shooting machine gun fire, right? But we don't do that anymore. So really, when you go through the door, the odds are there's going to be like an old man standing there with his hands up. And behind him is going to be a door or a curtain. And you don't know what's behind that door. You know, it could be a bomb factory, or it could be like the ladies of his family in stages of undress, right? Like you don't have any idea what's back there. And there's a language barrier between you two. And so when you're trying to tell him what to do and order him around, he doesn't know what you're saying. And even when this guy starts fighting you, right, you don't know that he's the enemy. You know what I mean? Now, if he grabs your rifle, there's no rules of engagement in the world that won't let you blow the guy away. He grabbed my rifle, right? But the whole town knows that you murdered old man Smith, who wouldn't hurt a fly. He just didn't want you to see his naked daughter. Right. So that's the way the battlefield actually works. Okay. So you have a moral responsibility as a soldier to be able to handle that guy. And you have a moral responsibility as a leader to train your soldiers to be able to handle that guy. Because look, if I'm sending young lieutenants out to the force all the time, right? You know, it's not going to be them that shoots old man Smith. It's going to be one of the soldiers in their unit. You know what I mean? And you know what's going to happen to that soldier? You're going to shoot that guy, and you're going to go through that curtain, and you're going to see those young ladies back there, and then you're going to realize, holy shit, I murdered that guy. And you're going to have to live with that shit forever, right? Okay, so it'll be the leader's, the cowardly leader's fault that dude got murdered, because the leader's ego wouldn't let them risk being embarrassed by training combatives. Right. So that's actually the truth, right? Like that's the way the battlefield plays. And if you have a hammer, every problem looks like a nail, right? We carry rifles. Every problem isn't a target. You have a responsibility to be able to go over, lay hands on those people, and then handle them. And that's what combatives is. It's that ability right there.
So with that, how would you, practically speaking, how would you recommend rolling combatives out? And then, like, I guess as a follow-on, what are some of the pitfalls you've seen as leaders have tried to create those kinds of programs?
So what I tell everybody is, like I said, until the chief of staff of the Army says, hey, we're all going to do this, and starts mandating the people to do it, then it's up to leaders to take those responsibility to build a program within their unit. Because when you show up to a new unit, you're a leader. Like, imagine you're a sergeant first class and you roll into a new unit. The odds that you're going to roll into a functioning combatives program are virtually zero. Mm-hmm. You know, so what you're going to have to do is make it happen, right? Okay, so here's the crux of how you actually do that. Okay, so to be successful, any program that you're going to put into an organization, it's got to first fit within the culture of the organization. And I'll explain what I mean by that in a second. And then once you fit it into the culture, then it has to have a transformative effect on the culture. So fitting into the culture is a good example, right? So the Army Combatives Program is built around a series of drills that can be utilized as a component of fitness training. Okay, so they're not to ever replace fitness training, right? Because if you say, for example, we're going to do fitness, you know, Monday through Wednesday, and then on Friday and on Thursday, we're going to do combatives. What you're really doing is you're doing a class that day and you're not doing PT, right? Because when you're doing a class on combatives, that means it's like two of us up here showing people stuff and everybody's sitting on their ass. And then we're going to like do like a 6 or 8 repetitions of that thing we just showed you. Nobody's breaking a sweat. It isn't PT, right? So it should never be done. Combatives class should never be done as part of PT. But if you say, for example, okay, so we're going to do, as part of our warm-up today, we're going to do some cooperative pummeling. So that's what they're doing to warm up in every wrestling room in the world, right? So it's a good warm-up. And it also is teaching you to pummel for the underhooks, which is a combat skill. So you can say, okay, now we're going to, switch over, do 2 minutes of cooperative pummeling. Then later on in the workout, you can say, okay, now we're going to do 3 3-minute rounds of competitive pummeling, which is going to smoke everybody's bags, and it's learning to fight, right? So all the drills are like that. They can either fit within the warm-up session or they can fit within the workout session, and they're designed specifically for that purpose. And if you say, for example, if I'm the new platoon leader, new platoon sergeant, something like that, you say, okay, squad leaders, you're going to create your physical training plan for your squads, right? Because you're the leader. You don't want to take that away from them. You want them to be responsible for that. But I'm responsible to the commander for that stuff. So we're going to work on this together, right? So you come up with a plan, present it to me, then we're going to talk through it and make sure it's meeting all my requirements and the commander's requirements, right? So one of those requirements can be every day we'll have one thing of combatives in it. And we're talking about the equivalent of a set of sit-ups, right? You can do 2 minutes of the straight armbar drill from the guard, which is going to be just as good an ab workout as any kind of sit-ups or crunches or anything else you do, and you learn how to break somebody's arm. So the components are like that, right? So you say that, and then each when they come up with their plan, you just make sure that's in there, right? And then once you've made the plan, you buy off on it, has the force of an order now. Now you do your inspections, okay? Tuesday, I went out with second squad. They all said they were going to do drill number one. Nobody knew it. Well, last week you said you did it twice, so you're lying to me, right? You see what I mean? So just basic Army leadership stuff, and then you have that implemented in your unit. And then it's going to come down like, well, what if the second squad leader doesn't know combatives? Well, he has a responsibility to know combatives. If that squad leader was told, hey, next week you're going to have a class on the AT-4, he'd be an expert on the AT-4 before that time for him to present to everybody, right? Because all you need to know in the Army to know more, to be able to teach, is to know more than the people you're teaching about whatever it happens to be. And everybody's going to be better, right? So it's the same kind of system. You go out and learn because you're the boss and you're supposed to know. And then you pass on what you learn to your soldiers. And then pretty soon we have an Army full of people who know how to fight, because as soon as you get that going, I mean, like I said, remember we were talking about earlier about motivating everybody. If you said, okay, once a week or once every 2 weeks or something, we're going to have, 2 3-minute round live ground grappling or live neck wrestling or one of the other drills, everybody would start to know who's good and who's bad in the same way that you would for the run, and then you'd get that social dynamic going, and pretty soon there'd be pressure on everybody, social pressure on everybody to become better at it if they would like to be respected. And so that's all it kind of takes, right? That approach. You can see how that's built to be like a grassroots thing, so that a platoon leader, a platoon sergeant, a staff sergeant can implement it in their organization, because that's the way it had to grow, right? also of note, like that whole program is built around the idea that what do? Almost every place in the Army every morning at 06. Almost everyone in the Army, everybody goes, does PT, right?
Well, first you sing a song, but
yeah, something similar. But, you know, for example, and this is, so I have a very good friend named Dave Durnell, who used to work at First ID in the Army running the program out there. And now he's the guy in charge of the Air Force's program at the Air Force Academy. And so their program was built off of ours. But one difference between the Air Force and the Army is that we do PT every morning, right? So they can't have a program based upon that because they don't do it. They have to have a different sort of program because it has to fit within their culture. You see what I mean? So that's step one. It's kind of like, here's the culture. And ours was easy because I was a career soldier. And so I was able to, like, you know what our culture is from the inside. It wasn't like I was outside trying to design something to fit. And when I was contracting, I traveled around the world, like designing programs for other organizations. And each organization, they have their own cultural things like that, right? Like, just to give an example, in the Army, we know you come in, basic training, AIT. Then you go to your unit. It's going to look like this day to day and week to week and month to month in your unit. Then when you get to this rank, you're going to go to this school, and that's going to prepare you for the next rank. And here's the things you need to learn for the responsibilities that are at that level. And We know that, like, throughout the whole Army, right? So it's with that level of knowledge, you can design something that says, okay, at this point, you need to learn this, so we can insert this in the curriculum there. You see what I mean? And if you're, if your fitness program was going to be successful, that's exactly how you would do it. You'd say, okay, you have to learn this before you're a platoon sergeant, because this is what somebody who's in charge of 36 people or however many needs to know in order to manage that training at that level. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. I think one of the first questions that's going to come up, because Drew was asking about practical implementation of this in a unit, I think one of the first questions that's going to come up, and we addressed it early in this conversation, is the safety piece, right? And so I just want to ask about any specific injury considerations to keep in mind. And before I let you go, I will tell people, if this is something you want to dive into, there's a ton of this in the Combatives Manual, whole chapter on safety. And I'll highlight, it points out that attacks on major joints tend to be painful far before they're causing an injury, with some exceptions, right? Like the wrist, and then rotation at the knee tend to be some pretty high risk things. So like, what are those injury risk factors that we need to make people aware of early on as we're implementing something like this?
Okay. So first I should address the myth that it's dangerous. Okay. So at West Point, for example, we keep great statistics on all the different injuries that happen to the cadets, and combatives in our building where we teach. Well, the big ones are swimming, boxing, gymnastics, and combatives, but we teach a whole bunch of other stuff too. Weightlifting, you know, teach handball, you know, all kinds of stuff, right? So in that list of things that we teach, the one that has the best safety record is swimming, because the injuries tend to be catastrophic. So we're very, very safe about it, right? Like we're so
that's true.
Yeah. And listen, we have people show up who can't swim a stroke, right? And we have the responsibility to teach them how to swim. And we do. Mm-hmm. It's like we have the most fabulous program. But with that being said, the second best record of safety is combatives. So that is because, first off, we're adults and we know where the injuries happen. Okay. So for example, most of the injuries in combatives happen when you're doing throws and takedowns. Okay. So also coincidentally, on the battlefield, throws and takedowns aren't even really a thing. When you go through the door into an 8x10 room, the odds that you're going to square off with somebody and like hit the great hip throw or something are virtually zero. What you're really going to do is push them against the wall or over the couch or some shit like that, and then it's going to be game on, right? So this portion where every kid who wrestled in high school is the expert and wants to, like, because their ego is going to want to drive them to show everybody how tough they are, they're going to try to concentrate on this portion, which doesn't matter on the battlefield and which is where all the injuries happen. So we like nix that, right? Because we just barely do any throws and takedowns because it's not important on the battlefield, right? So that's a good example of like an adult approach. Like, here is where the risks are And we mitigate risks on that, just like everything else in the Army. That's what the whole chapter that you're mentioning in the TC is. It's about mitigating risks. Okay. Now I'll give you another, to put this all in context. Okay. You know what the most dangerous activity that soldiers took part in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan was?
Sports and PT.
Working out.
It was basketball.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. So more soldiers went home from basketball than any other thing. Yep. For your orthopedic injuries and whatnot. So if it was about safety, there would be a crusade against basketball. But
hey, listen, we're converting a lot of basketball courts into weight rooms. So the crusade is happening.
So it's happening, right? So but the truth is basketball is not that much more. If we played flag football and the numbers that we played basketball, we'd have similar sort of injury rate, right?
People are all over the board with injury stuff. I cite Steven Pinker's book all the time. It has nothing to do with fitness, but
yeah,
people tend to judge the likelihood of something happening based on the ease of recalling examples. And so they're like really memorable injuries that are stuck in their brain. But like, if we were really worried about physical training injury risk, we wouldn't run, because that's like the highest rate thing that we do for regular physical training. Nobody worries about the danger of running.
Right. Even though that's where all the injuries come from. Yeah. That's my point. Exactly. And then to build on that, I would say, listen, that's not actually the driver. That's the excuse of why people don't do combatives. The driver is actually fear of humiliation. So imagine people are afraid of combatives for the exact same reason they're afraid of public speaking, right? It's not because they're going to get out on stage and hurt themselves. It's because they're going to get out there and say something stupid, and then everybody's going to, like, their status is going to go down. People are afraid of combatives because they're going to get out there and somebody's going to twist them up and they're going to feel terrible about it, right? And they're going to be in front of everybody. Okay, so once we understand that, like, that's what it is, right? Then we can start to like address it. But also realize, look, we're not overcoming that. We're not ever going to overcome the fact that people are afraid to get humiliated, right? The only way we could is if we mandated it from the bottom so that you couldn't get to be an E6, an E7, a captain, a major without being a competent fighter, right? But as long as we've got a bunch of those people around who aren't competent fighters, which we do, the vast majority, okay? As long as we have those people, they're going to resist it.
I mean, realistically, I should probably admit that I'm not a very competent fighter at this point in the conversation.
Yeah, well, you listen, but
I've been publicly embarrassed.
But listen, that's just like, is this any different actually than what keeps people out of the weight room?
No, it's the same thing. Yeah.
It's exactly the same thing, right? People don't want to get in the weight room because they're afraid to look like a weakling. So they stay out of the weight room and never get strong.
And I think we avoid admitting it, which is why I appreciate the conversation being direct about it.
Yeah. I mean, that's our part, right? Our part is to like poke people in the eye when appropriate. You know what I mean? If you're not in the weight room and you're not strong, are you saying that it's not better to be strong? You know what I mean? As far as I can tell, there's no benefit to being a wee little man. You know what I'm saying? Get your ass stronger, right? So, you know, that's our part, right? Like I come back to like the fundamentals all the time, and here are the actual fundamentals. What's the mission of the Army? Fight and win our nation's wars. What portion of the Army is not involved in the fighting? No portion. The 507th Maintenance Unit proved that, right? There's no portion of the Army that doesn't move around a battlefield. And if you are in Space Command, or you're a cyber person, or you're running the field laundry, you're going to find yourself in vehicle number 3 of a convoy moving around the battlefield at some point. And when vehicle number 1 gets blown off the face of the earth and everybody burned alive, right? What are you going to do, Space Commando? Well, you're going to be a provisional infantryman, just like everybody else wearing that camouflage suit, because that's what we are. And if you're a commander and your organization is engaged in such like that, and you don't know how to fire maneuver your organization, because you thought you were a maintenance organization or something like that, you know, just imagine, right? If we were in Ukraine right now and you were in an organization was thinking about attacking the enemy, who would you attack? Would you attack the infantry, the armor formations, or would you attack the guys running the bulk fuel side, or, you know what I mean? Some portion of the Army where you would imagine that people would be less well-trained. That's exactly who is in combat, is all those people. And if we don't have a culture where the commander of that organization and the NCOs of that organization realize that their soldiers are the ones who are going to be doing the fighting on the battlefield, then our culture is broken. And it's just wrong, right? Like, that person is incompetent to be in command of that organization if that's their attitude. You know, so I've been around the Army for 40 years. You know, I came in when Reagan was president. You know what I'm saying? But there's like reoccurring things that I have seen throughout this time. I had my best friend who was worked at ROTC for a while, and he was in charge of the ROTC summer camps combatives training for a couple of summers, the one that was out at Lewis McChord. And so this is many years ago. We're talking about 20 years ago now. But whenever he was in charge of that, his boss, who was a lieutenant colonel, was a PMI at one of the major universities, was tasked to be in charge of that too. And so they told him to go to the level one combatives course. He's an infantry lieutenant colonel who retired out of the Army rather than go through the level one course. Let's just imagine that for a second. This is the person that we are theoretically going to entrust a 600 person battalion of infantry to their command. Right, we're saying this person's competent for that job, right? Same person who is afraid to escape them out, do the bent armbar. You know what I mean? Like, no, man, it's broken. And how do you get to be that person and still be a coward? Because that's what the guy is. Let's call it what it is. He's a coward. He should not be in that position. No matter what else he's got going on, he's a coward. And this is the Army. Why do we have that, you know?
So I know we got to move towards a close here. We're already over on time a little bit, but this has been awesome. I will reiterate something I said when we had our conversation with Colonel Gist a few months back, but just like being a cadet going through West Point, going through the DPE courses, I did not arrive there good at physical stuff. I arrived there good at academic stuff, and that's how I got in. And that's totally reasonable, but I still appreciate the like well-controlled, but like public humiliation kind of stuff. Cause like you have to reckon with the stuff you're bad at to get good at it. Like what's the Jake, the dog quote, the first step to being kind of good at something is to suck at it.
To be the fool. Right.
And yeah, I think there's like an element of this that is just willingness to put yourself in a position where you know you're going to struggle. Yeah. And I think that's something people are really, really afraid of.
Yeah. First off, let me just say that you being the guy who there is an academic and now you're a fitness guy, we're going to count that as one in the W column for DPE, right?
So he's still academic. He's still an academic.
Listen, I work in you guys know where I work. It's a building full of academic fitness people, right? That's what we got. But you know, look, in this conversation, you know, my part is to speak the truth, right? Like, people of character first seek the truth, and then they run the truth past their values, and then they decide upon their actions. Right. And we are often afraid to speak the truth because the truth is uncomfortable. So the stakes are war. Right. Like, there's, man, war is a very, very big deal and it really sucks. And I've had a bunch of friends killed in it. Right. And I'm going to channel those guys to make sure that I'm speaking what I know is the truth and that I'm saying what people need to hear. And poking the right people in the eye, because at the end of the day, you know, I would like it if more soldiers, but first off, I would like it if we started winning wars again. That'd be cool, you know? And then second, I would like it if more of our soldiers were victorious and came home alive and came home, like, not all screwed up by the experience, right? We haven't mentioned this at all, but you know, my academic training is in psychology, right? So like, that's a big angle for me about what this is all about, is how do you prepare people for the realities of the battlefield? You don't do it by talking nicely, because war's ugly, man.
Can you speak a little bit to that? Just the psychology of the combatives program, why that piece of it is important, we've sort of, there's been a conversation ongoing this whole time about this warrior ethos, and a huge piece of that is the psychological aspect, the mindfulness aspect. And I'm curious to just let you riff on that.
Well, so first off, let me say this, that the combatives program is more about psychology than it is about hand-to-hand combat. Mm-hmm. Although hand-to-hand combat is ubiquitous on an urban battlefield, because people are forced into small spaces. And when you're attacking a hill, right? Like, people flee when they get scared. But when you're attacking a building, they don't, because they feel safe in their little cocoon until you come in the room with them. And now when you're in an 8x8 room, it's not a marksmanship contest, right? It's a fight in there. So hand-to-hand is happening more and more on the modern battlefield instead of less and less as the technology people would think. I mean, even in, like, imagine Ukraine, there's drones everywhere. What happens if you're in the open? Munitions come down on you, right? So Everybody hides. So when you're hiding, you're in small spaces. So that being said, it's actually more about knowing that you're the ones who are going to do the fighting than anything else. You know, you guys know about the 507th Maintenance Unit and Jessica Lynch and all that stuff. Okay, so, you know, what was wrong in that unit was everybody, you go back and look at her interview sometimes, she'll tell you, she said everybody in her experience, all her leaders reassured her that she would not be the one doing the fighting. There are other people who did that, right? Okay, so that's irresponsible leadership. And not only that, it's a lie. Turns out she was the one who had to do the fighting, because every soldier is, right? So how do we get that idea throughout the entire army so that we all know that, right? So that's what the combatives program is. If you're fighting all the time, it's hard to, like, ignore the fact that you might be doing the fighting, you know? And it's just like, you know, why do you need to be fit in the army? Well, if you're fighting all the time, that's pretty obvious, because you're getting balled up if you're not fit, right? Like, why do you need to be strong? Well, when that guy who's stronger than you, like, pushes your arm around behind your back, like, figure it out. Well, I need to be stronger. You know what I mean? So that's all that portion. There's a lot more to it than that. Like, without going too much on a tangent, you know, like, so we're finding out now that a lot of what we called PTSD in the old days. So it's like PTSD is like this big bucket of things that we throw in that are all, they're related in that they show similar symptoms. But you know what else has similar symptoms? The flu and nerve agent. Because our body only has a certain amount of defensive mechanisms, and whenever the nerve agent or the flu virus hits you, it deploys them, right? And so they look the same if you're just looking at the symptoms. Well, that's the same thing with traumatic brain injury and moral injury, for example, or maladjustment to a combat zone, right? So those things all have very similar symptoms. So the largest of those in the modern wars has been moral injuries. So moral injury is whenever you have a deeply held belief that gets destroyed by reality. Okay. So I'm saying it that way on purpose, because the psychology world, they're caregivers, right? They look at people who are broken and they try to fix them. Okay. So that means they're looking at the symptoms and then trying to figure out interventions that can help this person, instead of looking at the causal agent, right? And then figuring out what that actually is. So for example, the idea that war is some sort of anomaly, right? Which is like the guys who came up with the definition of, or the idea of PTSD, they were anti-war activists from the Vietnam era, right? So they thought war was this aberration, that peace was normal. Well, peace isn't normal. If you look across human history, right? What's really abnormal is like growing up, living in a peaceful society your whole life, and then dying with your family around you at the hospital as you breathe your last breath, right? Like that is not the way human beings have lived throughout our evolutionary past, right? Okay, so we actually have always been fighting forever. And if you go back far enough in our evolutionary past, like the number one cause of death becomes, you know, conspecific violence, right? Death from other humans, right? Okay, so that's normal. And war isn't more horrible than it used to be, right? When chimpanzees fight each other, they eviscerate each other and dance into viscera. Like, it's just as horrible as anything on the modern battlefield, right? And that's our ancestral environment. Okay, so then if you grew up, for example, with these moral ideas that you came to in a peaceful society, and then you find out what the world is really like, because that's what combat is. It's a window into reality of the world. I'll give you an exact analogy. Nature lovers love the butterfly and the sunset, right? That's nature. But so is Ebola, right? And so is those wolves tearing the guts out of that downed buffalo while it's still alive. It's fucking horrible, but it's true, and it's real nature. And so you say you're a nature lover, but that's nature. Okay, so war is showing you that part of human existence. And it comes down like this, right? You, your whole life, we grew up, my dad's an electrician, my mom's a nurse. I grew up in a peaceful society. I'm from Houston, Texas, right? My parents knew about as much about war as regular Americans do, and their morality was like regular American morality, right? Okay, so you grew up like that your whole life. You've heard it was a terrible thing to kill a child, right? Okay, so then the bad guys hide behind their children. They're shooting at you, right? And if you don't shoot back, you're going to die. So what do? Well, you shoot them and live. And then you live with the fact that you killed this child forever because you had this idea that this was a terrible thing. Well, is it a terrible thing? Well, it's terrible, sure, but is it morally wrong for you to shoot this person? Because I can tell you what the law of war says about it. The law of war says that guy's a war criminal, not you. You know what I mean? So warriors have to think through the reality of the world in the ways that people don't have to think through it who aren't going to be confronted with those sort of realities. But that's how it plays out in the world, you know? Like, there are going to be non-combatants running around the battlefield. We're going to be laying scunion, and some of those people are going to get killed. And the bad guys are going to be immoral actors. They're going to hide their stuff in, like, you know, places where you're not supposed to be able to shoot. They're going to shoot at you from them. You know, I wasn't in Somalia, but the guys who were said that, like, guys would run out in the street and shoot at you. And we shoot that guy, right? Then they send another guy out to get that rifle because they didn't have enough to go around. So then you shoot that guy. So then they send that 8-year-old out. First time he gets the rifle and goes back, and then you have another adult to deal with. Next time you shoot that guy, because you're going to die if you don't. Okay, so that's the reality of the world. And that's the kind of stuff that soldiers do because it's life and death and the battlefield demands it. And then you have to deal with it, right? Well, how do you train people for that? Well, the first thing you got to do is teach them to be able to understand what the world is, and then to be able to look with a critical eye at their deeply held beliefs. Because the problem isn't that the world is just a terrible place. The world is a terrible place. Lots of terrible shit happens. Lots of beautiful shit happens too. Okay. The problem is that you had beliefs that couldn't stand up to reality. Mm. Couldn't stand up to what was going to be. And that's not just that either. Like imagine this one, right? So in biology, animals deal with threats along an imminence continuum, right? So things that are far away, you deal with differently than things that are close. So if we're gazelles and we're like smelling a lion in the air, we will change our grazing patterns because we're dealing with the problem intellectually, right? So it's in our prefrontal cortex. But if the lion jumps out of the weeds at us, we're not going to deal with it intellectually. The brain activity is going to go down to our hypothalamus and our root brain and that. And whenever that happens, we're going to, you know, what we're going to call among humans, panic. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's like all animals, not just gazelles. Right. So that means when you get ambushed as a soldier, you're going through the exact thing mentally that gazelle's going through. Exactly the same thing. Your brain activities go into your root brain and you're doing what we call panic. Now, so imagine this cop comes up on a car and he's like hiding behind the door frame and whatnot. Bad guy, he's talking to him. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, he's done this 1,000 times. Out of nowhere, the guy presents a gun, starts shooting at him. Cops suddenly in a gunfight. What does he do? He's in that situation. Most likely thing he's going to do is flee. And then he's probably going to like get his weapon into action, come back in and engage it with courage, do the right thing, because that's almost always what happens. But this cop is probably going to beat himself up over that moment when he thought he was being a coward. He wasn't being a coward. He's just being a mammal. You know what I mean? So like a realistic understanding of what happens in battle, it's critical to your mental health. Like it's critical to the idea that you're going to be able to get through it and be able to come back and be like a normal person, hold down a job, raise children. Because that's our part, right? Like our part as the leaders in the army is we take the sons and daughters of America, we turn them into warriors, not just warriors. We're not raising Vikings, right? We turn them into the sort of warriors that a republic can be proud of, ethical warriors who don't kill old man Smith. You know what I mean? And then we bring them home and we turn them back over to the world, I mean, our country, and they have to go out and be normal people. right? And so that's our responsibility too, that whole thing from inception to retirement and beyond. We have that responsibility. And so that, look, combatives is an inherent part of that, in my opinion, because I've tried my best to design it as much as possible to be able to handle, or at least in part address, that reality of how we get them to be warriors, what kind of warriors, and then how do we make sure they can come home and be normal people.
So I got to ask before we let you go, because we've talked about cultivating the warrior spirit. We've talked about, you know, you mentioned every soldier should be prepared to engage. Obviously, the Jessica Lynch story, prime example. What comes to mind to me is the Marine Corps. Every Marine or rifleman, they get it. They also have a combatives program. So my question for you, the father of Army combatives, which branch wins in a fight?
So it's a good question. I was a Marine, for the record.
I was going to say, if he didn't say it, I was going to say it first. He started out in the Marine Corps, so he's got a bias here.
I was a Marine as a teenager, 17 to 21.
Hey, when they say once a Marine, always a Marine. So there's no was. Well,
I am very happy that I started out my life in the Marine Corps. It was a really great place to be a teenager. And I'm also quite glad that I switched over to the Range Regiment.
Great place to be an adult.
It's a very good place to be an adult, right? So with that being said, look, I will take a second to give you a difference. Please. Between the two programs. As I said earlier, the Marine Corps, the Commandant of the Marine Corps dictated the Marine Corps have a martial art. And so if you did that, imagine if you were the Commandant, how would you do it? Well, you'd find a really squared away Marine or some really squared away Marines who knew a lot about martial arts, and then you would have them design the program, right? That's just what they did. The guys who designed the program were excellent Marines, and they designed it along what they knew of the martial arts, which was primarily the traditional martial arts. And so the pedagogies and training methodologies all mirror the traditional martial arts. So it was very similar. A Marine has a logbook. Every time he trains, he signs off on the training. When he has a certain amount of training done, he's eligible to go test for the next belt, demonstrates the techniques and whatnot, gets promoted. It was very similar to a child's Taekwondo class. Show up for a certain amount of classes, come show your katas, you're promoted, right? So that's only problem with that is if it was not in the Marine Corps, it wouldn't actually be that good. But it is in the Marine Corps. So since it's in the Marine Corps, it has really tough people involved in it. And so therefore, it's pretty good, right? Because it's the Marines, man. They're freaking pretty tough crew. Okay, but that wouldn't necessarily work as well for the Army, because ours is about transformation of the culture more than anything else. Theirs is about piggybacking off of a warrior culture. Does that make sense, right? Mm-hmm. And so ours is about how do we get all the people in the various portions of the Army to think like warriors. So ours is more about the training methodologies themselves are more like an MMA gym. You know, what you see going on in a platoons in ours is way more like people, you know, grappling, and it's not like memorize these techniques. The only techniques we have to memorize are the very bottom ones, and that's because the only place where you have to force people to do techniques where you would measure something is at the very bottom. After that, it's ad lib. So the program is more like, you know, what are the things you must know about fire maneuver? You know, well, so you must know how to lead your unit in fire maneuver. But the terrain is always going to be different. The situation is always going to be different. You're going to have to adapt and overcome using these principles. Our program is a lot more like that. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So I would also mention too, like every Marine or rifleman thing. Okay, when I was in the Marine Corps, it was when PX Kelly this is how old I am. When Reagan was president and PX Kelly was the commandant. The next commandant after him was a guy named Al Gray, who commanded the 2nd Marine Division, who was a freaking stud, right? And he came in and changed the Marine Corps. Mandatory road march miles for everybody in the Marines. Everybody had to go to the rifle range more often, da, 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 da. What he did was he made that every Marine or rifleman thing happen. Like he made it real. Right, because it wasn't that way before, really. Okay, mm-hmm. So with that being said, that's the same sort of transformation from the bottom that we're trying to make happen with the combatives program in the Army. How do we get it so that the members of, I should say this, so combatives programs are easier to build in places where you wouldn't imagine it. You know, we used to have the best program in the Army was at Fort Lee, Virginia. So Fort Lee is where all the
logistics university,
right? Yeah. So that place there had the greatest program because imagine the non-commissioned officer education system out in the Army, right? In the infantry, nobody's coming to you as a squad leader in a Ranger regiment and saying, you know, you should think about being an instructor in the NCOES program, right? Nobody's doing that. Everybody's like, that guy's a kick-ass squad leader, keep him there until he's a platoon sergeant, right? So who ends up in those schools? Well, it's people sometimes who are not the ones that you want in the line squads. Now, if everybody joins the Army to play soldier, right? So if you're like running the field laundry or something, you're some logistician job, right? The best soldiers volunteer for those kind of jobs. So your best drill sergeants, your best, and your, the NCOS program that they had at Fort Lee was top notch. It was so badass. Like I said, I used to travel around the Army. I got there and I was just like, yeah, like this. This is the way it should look around the Army, right? Like super great soldiers, really doing great stuff. And they were teaching people to fight, right? Like it was a great program, right? And so it's like that in to understand about the Army that you know, we have the raw material everywhere to do it. You know, we have some challenges, you know, like people who have gravitate towards the combatives program. Sometimes they want to be like the Army to pay for their amateur MMA career instead of like being top-notch soldiers. You know what I'm saying? So those are kind of like hurdles that are built into the challenge of the program. We have to be able to find the person who is the right person, who's going to be a fighter, you know, and also be all about the Army's mission, et cetera, and being a top-notch soldier. You know, I just had two of my guys that worked for me, one a tanker, one an attack helicopter pilot, who just did a 50K run this past weekend. You know what I mean? And they're combatives guys, you know, they're like tough ass fighters. Okay. They're also just really top-notch soldiers. That's what's required. You know, you have to be focused on what's the Army mission. What are we trying to accomplish here? How do we make this organization into what it needs to be to fight and win our nation's wars? You know, that's the point.
So
now he's got to answer the question.
Who wins in a fight?
Whichever side I'm on. Because I'm going to wreck people. I promise you.
Brilliantly. Brilliantly done. Oh, man. All right. I feel like we could go on for hours, but seriously, thank you for coming on. This was
fantastic.
Alex is going to struggle to get one soundbite out of all of them. So
I have to pick between like 20 incredible sounds. Usually it's like finding one good one. Now it's picking between like 20 amazing ones.
Okay, yeah. Great.
This has been awesome.
It's been fun, guys. If you guys want to have me back sometime, just let me know. I'll be happy to come on.
Absolutely.
Yes, to that, man. He said some really important stuff in really direct ways that you do not get all the time. He did not hedge. He did not like question his takes. Those are just nonstop, really important hot takes that go way beyond combatives, delivered very directly.
But I think you could argue that maybe not exclusively because of his combatives aptitude, but like that's a part of it that allows him to speak with confidence on topics, mm-hmm. which really in a roundabout way gets to the whole point of what he was trying to make, which was that in order to foster or facilitate this kind of warrior culture, mm-hmm. you have to be good at this. In a lot of ways, this sounds very existential, but it felt like from talking to him that like combatives becomes a metaphor for a lot of the issues that we deal with.
We didn't even plan to talk about the psychology of it, and we didn't even start talking about the psychology of it until we'd already gone over the hour mark, but we're going to have to go back into that later. Yeah, there was just as much value in the psychology of combat and the psychology of violence and stuff like that, that I think is a whole future conversation on its own.
Yeah, I just, man, like, you know, you listen to him, you're like, shit, why don't I know how to choke somebody out? I should be better.
Went on, man, I felt more and more guilty for the fact that I haven't fought somebody in a long time.
Fight. Next time we're around each other, we'll fight.
Oh, man.
More than you. More than you, but you went to
West. We'll do it anyway.
We'll fight anyway. Problem is, people are going to hear this and they're going to see us at a conference and be like, you're supposed to be fighting.
People heard in the episode, I acknowledge that I'm not particularly good at combatives, but I will say one of my proudest moments in combatives, like first graded fight, I fought a kid who was easily 30 pounds heavier than me. And like I said, I was not good at technique. I didn't have a lot of moves in my repertoire. The only one really was the guillotine. So I just hugged people until I could guillotine them.
I'm a lover, not a fighter, guys.
That was essentially my entire method.
Just fighting you.
And it worked on this guy. I beat him resoundingly and relatively quickly, and he was so upset about it after the class. Like, as soon as the fight was over, he went over to the instructor and was like, what just happened, and how do I make sure that never happens again? Like,
and now, ever since that point,
extremely satisfying to beat somebody heavier than you.
That guy, to this day, still has not let anyone hug him. So
I think he fought me again later and won, so he did, like, figure out what was going on. But at least it worked one time.
That's awesome. Well, we'll put a bow on this one. Fantastic episode. Thoroughly enjoyed it. And he will be back. So, we'll see you guys next week. Hey, Alex, let's cover our ass real quick.
Oh, great idea, Drew. All right, guys. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode. Before you go, please rate and review the pod on the listening platform of your choice. You can also visit us on our website at www.mopsinmos.com. That's mops, the letter N, mos.com. You can check out the library of podcast episodes, our latest blog entries, any helpful resources, and also sign up for our newsletter.
Drew nailed it. Just to underline a couple of things, the podcast entries have in-depth show notes on the website. So if you missed anything or you want to read any of the research we talk about, it is all there. You can, at the bottom of the website, sign up with your email and receive future updates from us. The blog posts go a little bit more in-depth in kind of written form on a couple of topics we get questions about all the time. But most importantly, I just want to ask all you guys, our best way the word gets out is absolutely word of mouth. So tell your friends, tell the people you work with, anybody you think would find it useful. Thanks for spreading the word.
If you have any questions or comments, feel free to shoot us an email at either Drew or Alex at mopsandmos.com.
Or there's a contact form on the website.